Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome and thanks for joining me. I just got off the Skype phone to talk with Erica Fox Brindley about her new book, Ancient China and the Yue, Perceptions and Identities on the Southern Frontier, circa 400 BCE to 50 CE. This came out in 2015 with Cambridge University Press. Now, this is a book that simultaneously does at least two different really important kinds of work. At the same time that it brings us into a very specific case study, which is also really, really important for anybody who works on China and as remotely interested in, which I think many of us are, issues of selfhood and identity, especially when we understand what's happening across the frontier in different periods of Chinese history, and the ways of conceptualizing, naming, and talking about and understanding non-Chinese, what you can sort of, in scare quotes, I'm saying that, non-Chinese peoples and Yue peoples in particular. At the same time, it's also offering us some much more generally applicable ways of both problematizing some very common ways of understanding China, its histories and its identities, and also much more broadly thinking about the production of, the construction of, the emergence of identity, ethnicity, much more broadly. So what Erica does is she focuses in on a particular group of peoples that are named Yue that are local to the southern frontier in early China. It shows us, or the book shows us, the ways that the Huaxia people are, in the words of the book, constructing their own identities vis-a-vis southern difference. And this focus on the southern frontier instead of the more kind of commonly focused on north or the northwestern frontiers is one of many important contributions of the study. So over the course of the book, Erica takes us into some important sort of concentrations of kinds of evidence that are going to help us understand the production of Yue identity and the ways that it acts as a foil for the production of Huaxia identity and ideas of centrality. And these include evidence from the field of historical linguistics, from archaeology, and from textual study in various different ways. And over the course of the conversation, you'll hear us talk about everything from pre-Austronesian language to magical knives and hairstyles. It's a really fun study, as well as being a very comprehensive study of this particular area of focus. So it was great fun talking with Erica again. We've had a chance to talk before. I've been lucky enough to talk with her before about her previous book. And listeners who are familiar with that conversation and then listen to this one will kind of see or hear the ways in which these projects relate to each other. And by the end of the conversation, you'll hear also a little bit more about what's to come and how these fit into a larger project. So I'll let you get right to it. Thanks as ever for listening, for your support of the channel, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Erica Fox Brindley about her new book, Ancient China and the Yue. Welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, Erica. It's great to have you back on the show. And thanks for writing a book that's so inspiring and that I'm personally really excited to talk with you about. So welcome and thank you.
Thanks so much for having me again, Carla.
Of course. So, Erica, since we've already had a chance to talk about what brought you to the field, and listeners can go to that interview and we'll link to that in the write-up on the site, let's get right to it and get right into the book and right into the project. So we've talked already about your previous book in a previous conversation. How did you come from that area of research, from that project, to this book? And what brought you to decide to do a book-length object on the Yue and problems of identity specifically?
Well, I hadn't set out with either of these, the latest two books, to actually write books. It was just after I had done my dissertation, I was so sick of the first project and I didn't want to see it. I wanted to put it aside and not think about it for several years. And so I got busy on just kind of articles and projects that I thought were interesting that I had never really taken up as a graduate student. So this is way back in, like, you know, 2001, 2002. And one of the projects, I mean, actually both Yue projects, they're both weirdly enough on the Yue, but one is music Yue and the other one is the ancient ethnonym Yue, which is what we're talking about today. And for some reason, I was very interested in the way people were conceptualizing self. This kind of goes back to my original interest in my first research project on kind of identity and the self and human agency. I had actually in the late 1990s, I had gotten into Southeast Asia and gone to Vietnam. And I was really, really interested in learning Vietnamese and kind of exploring Southeast Asia as a new kind of frontier of China. And slowly, bit by bit, the history of this region, because it was so fascinating, and I'm just in love with not just China, but most of Southeast Asia as well. It just grabbed me as well, and I thought, oh my gosh, I am in a very unique position. I can read the classical texts, and you know, the histories of these peoples weren't really written in other language. They weren't written in Vietnamese. There was no ancient Vietnamese that they were writing in really early on, in the periods that I mostly deal with. And so I thought, wow, I have unique access to kind of being the person who could try to uncover, you know, at least the historical record, and try to piece together the connections between China and Southeast Asia, you know, early on. And that to me was just a really compelling project. And so I started writing on, you know, I just kind of picked out what was then to me the nomenclature, the name that the classical Chinese people had been using to refer to the people of the southernmost or at least southeasternmost regions. And also it happened to be one that was relevant to Vietnam because Yue is Viet in classical Chinese. So I thought, well, that's great. Why don't I try to explore this connection and see where I go with that?
Great. So what I'll do is just spend a few minutes kind of laying the foundation so that listeners can have an overall sense of the kind of overall scope of the book, and then we'll dive in and kind of get to the particulars and the introduction and beyond. So the preface of the book opens the study by offering a really critical perspective on the way that ethnicities are conceived in China, kind of generally speaking. It pushes back on a couple of ideas and tendencies. It pushes back on the one hand on the idea that Chinese people share the same genetic heritage. And it also asks us to challenge the assumption that, in the words of the book, large, continuous, and homogeneous was the natural state for China and its peoples. It really wants to ask us to be much more locally and historically situated and pay attention to the kinds of contingencies that created and still create in a lot of ways of embodying, identifying, and talking about kinds of identity. So the book instead looks very closely at what it calls the mechanics of one's identification with Chinese culture, or the mechanics of Chinese identity as it functioned in history. And it does this by focusing on the Huaxia and the peoples associated with its southern frontier. You just mentioned the Yue or the Viet in the pre-imperial and Qin Han period textual corpus, and also looks at some archaeological sort of material and linguistic evidence. Now, ultimately, and I'm going to sort of wrap up in a moment, the book shows that, in its own words, articulations of the self and Yue and the Yue other were shaped by specific contextual needs or political exigencies. And it's ultimately going to argue that what it calls an imperial logic of centrality, it, again in the words of the book, played an important role in the unification of a Huaxia center and self, and hence the construction of marginal others in the process. So that's kind of the foundation for where we are and where we're ultimately going to go. And I hope listeners can, in hearing that, appreciate one of the things that I really love about the book, which is just as much as it is, and at the same time that it's very, very focused on and very carefully focused on a very specific historical case, it offers us ways to think much more broadly, well beyond the case of the Yue, and even China specifically, to really think much more broadly about issues of identity and its construction and its sort of local contingencies and local conditions of emergence. So I think there's so much to talk about here. So let's get right into it. Part one gives us a set of orientations, and it's called Orientations, Definitions, and Disciplinary Discussions. And we'll talk a little bit about this. You raise a question in the introduction that I'd really love for you to kind of open up the project by talking a little bit about here. Here's the question the introduction raises. How does a historian of texts go about investigating a group that left no written record, but nonetheless helped deeply shape the dominant group's self-identity and historical trajectory? So, Erica, if you could you talk a little bit about that particular historiographical challenge? How do you go about investigating a group like this that left no texts, but were so important for the history that you're trying to understand?
That was a question that I was grappling with throughout. And so the format of the book ended up just transforming over and over again as I progressed. Originally, I wanted to do something related to cross-cultural interactions, and the deeper I got into this kind of project, the more I realized, you know, nobody's doing anything, not even the bare basics of understanding, like, who were the Yue and how is this. Unfortunately, the term Yue was constantly changing, and it was so hard to pin down and so hard to kind of even discuss, even mentioning it once. You know, you'd have this qualification and this footnote that would last like, you know, half a page. And I was like, I can't write that. You know, somebody's got to write a kind of more basic foundational book that kind of gets all these issues straight. And then we can proceed to, questions of imperial control and reach and all these things that I thought I wanted to do from the very beginning. But to get back to your question of sources, this was just something that just, you know, I realized, well, okay, I can deal with these sources, but they're all so biased, right? And there were a lot of people throughout this project that were, they kind of take a more positivistic view of history, like, oh no, we want to know exactly what these people were doing and who these people were, and not just names and who they're called, what they're called, and things like that. And I started resisting that kind of approach very vigorously, because I felt like, you know, that's the kind of argument that basically throws the baby out with the bathwater. It's like saying, oh, only material evidence, you know, and these kinds of social science approaches of linguistics or archaeology, that, you know, because we don't want to rely on the texts because they're so biased, then the only truthful kind of or authentic approach is to take this materialistic or linguistic approach. And And I really resisted that. And I also resented it. because I felt like, you know, we're historians, and historians look at a lot of them, you know, try to use a lot of different materials, but texts are very, very basic. And so surely, you know, we've been taught a lot of us to, you know, to recognize these biases and try to test the limits of these biases in our work. And that's what we do. And so I was interested in actually saying, look, you know, we can't just not look at the historical record, because actually even archaeologists do, and they use it very uncritically sometimes. So historians, I felt, could add to the conversation by bringing their expertise in critical readings and a much broader sense of the literary and textual tradition to start to give everybody and the whole conversation, you know, people involved in this conversation, insights into what the texts are useful for. And I came to the conclusion, and partly the whole project was shaped, this whole emphasis on identity and perceptions of identity, that was shaped by what I felt like the historical text could offer us in terms of the biggest impact that they could make was to talk about these kinds of self-conceptions and conceptions of the other. And that was where we could make the contribution as historians. And so that's kind of how I dealt with that issue, by trying to tailor the actual pursuit and the questions I asked towards the methodological problems of having these biased sources.
That's right. And one of the things that's really exciting about this part of the book, and this part of the book does, you know, deal with, and in separate chapters, the problems of and the opportunities of working with archaeological evidence and linguistic evidence, and we'll get to that a little bit in a moment. But it really does raise these issues as problems to think with, rather than bringing them up and then dismissing them, or rather than trying to just not deal with them head on at all, which would be much less useful, right? So you talk here in chapter one about some of the problems in trying to examine U.S. self-identity or U.S. voice. Like, what could that look like? You know, what might it look like to look at some of the sources that might gesture towards something like that? And you also make the important point here that there was no single U.S. people. The term encompassed very different groups of people depending on who was using it and how and when. But it does help us understand the kind of interconnected histories of the southern frontier. And you talk about in the first chapter the entire South China and Southeast Asia or Oceania region as a kind of macrosphere. Now, this sense of interconnectedness and the importance of interconnectedness comes up really importantly in chapter two, where you're taking us into linguistic research here. It looks at the problem of the spoken language of the peoples designated by the term U.S. And you raise a question that we won't get into too many details here, but for people who are listening who are particularly interested in historical linguistics, you raise the question, did they primarily speak pre- or proto-Austronesian, Austroasiatic, Hmong Mien, or all of the above? And like, why is that important? And the chapter concludes by suggesting that the majority of the inhabitants of the ancient state of Yue probably spoke a pre-Austronesian language that was related to the various Austronesian languages that developed in Taiwan and possibly southern Fujian. So without needing to necessarily go into all of the details, I mean, the chapter does that, and it does it quite compellingly. Why is that important for the larger story you're telling us here, to conclude that about the linguistic kind of nature of the spoken languages of the Yue?
Well, as part of the general background that I wanted to give so that basically people could get their bearings straight with the Yue, I knew that I couldn't only just touch on this topic without actually trying to address the question of, well, there were actual Southerners in this area, and there were natives, and they had very different cultures and languages and material cultures and all sorts of and interactions and networks. And you kind of have to address those issues. That's what I felt, that, you know, to give a larger kind of background story. But besides that, what was more interesting to me was the idea that since we're talking about identities, and identity formation and preservation and kind of the construction and maintenance of it is, to me, you know, it's ongoing and it's always transforming itself. And it happens in the present day, and you see these identities, such as the Polynesians. And I also have a deep love for Hawaii, so this kind of this project drew me into areas of kind of you know, what was this deep history of the Polynesian past when they were actually, you know, what if we took it farther than the starting point, which is Taiwan, which most, you know, linguists and archaeologists agree that was the jumping off point for the great Polynesian migration. Well, are we talking with this early history of the Chinese of mainland, or East Asian mainland is probably more appropriate? Are we talking basically of an extension of the histories of peoples who have identities that are really, really relevant to the modern day, and not just Vietnam, because Vietnam has this word Viet in it, but really, you know, thinking very broadly to try to encompass and recreate lines of history that I think lots of contemporary peoples who identify with Oceania or Polynesian, you know, the Polynesian migrations and the Austronesians who were that's the linguistic group that, you know, turned into kind of the Polynesians at some point in, you know, one branch at least. And, you know, to try to include this area of history and see that the East Asian mainland had a lot going on and that it was a really, really diverse place. And so part of, you know, part of the project was to kind of uncover that diversity for everybody.
Great. And the next chapter also, we won't talk about this in any kind of real detail, but the next chapter also does that work. So just for listeners who are particularly interested in the book's explicit engagement, not just with archaeological evidence, because that happens throughout the book, but also with the problem of engaging a historiography of archaeological evidence and, you know, trying to figure out how to use that historiography and the evidence itself to tell the story that the book is going to tell. What this chapter does is, through a careful look at archaeological evidence, it uses that to identify two main networks of interaction along the southern frontier. So this really just kind of emphasizes and buttresses what you've just said. This becomes important, and we can talk about this a little bit later if you'd like, in part because it kind of emphasizes and justifies the use of the Yue as a term to group peoples together in the period you're looking at. And we're going to see the kind of ramifications and the textures of that in the textual records that you bring us into as we move through the book. Now, there's also a chapter that we're also not going to talk too much about. There are a lot of wonderful chapters in this book, listeners. So this is why we're not going to have time to talk about all of them. But I want to make sure that you know that they're there so that when you do go to the book, you can see these. There's also a part two. This is a part of the book that looks at the kind of timelines and political histories of the U.S. state and the Han period U.S. kingdoms. And it provides the political background for some of the major states in this period that were associated with Yue peoples and cultures. Okay, and it's really, really interesting. And we'll touch on some of the kind of political history as it plays out in the texts in the conversation to come. Okay, this brings us to part three and chapter five. This is super fascinating for all kinds of reasons.
Oh, so, great.
Yes, I love this. So let's get into it. Now, chapter five turns us to Chinese texts to see how they treat the issues of identity that are explored in other kinds of evidence in previous chapters. And it looks at the various language of the Huaxia self that, as you put it in the book, helps create both Huaxia and Yue identity. And this looks at specifically ethnic, political, and cultural representations of the Yue other. So let's get into the texts. You talk here about one example that seems really important to the story that you're telling and seems really fascinating for all kinds of reasons. And that's a particular way of conceptualizing the self in ethnic terms in the Analects. So you talk about the clear ethnic conceptualization of the Chinese self as Huaxia or Zhuxia in the Analects. Can you bring us into that and the importance of that? What's going on in that case? And for you, why is it so crucial for what's happening here?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because to me, in my mind, it is really, really kind of the linchpin upon which most of my arguments are based. And it was really, this was an early piece of work that I had done. That was the first article I came out with dealing with the Yue. And you know, and so you can see the kind of movement from ancient Chinese texts and intellectual, you know, philosophical texts towards this other topic of ethnicity, in this very kind of section. And it was really, I got all involved in, well, what is ethnicity? How do scholars define it? How do scholars of later China, most of them doing Manchu, you know, Qing history, because there's been more work on ethnicity with that. But not just them, you know, how about scholars doing classical Greece and other, you know, other parts of Europe, et cetera, start working with this idea of ethnicity. And the one definition I thought was really, really useful was this ancient scholar, and he's not ancient, he's a scholar of ancient Greece, and his name was Jonathan Hall, and his work on Hellenism and the ancient Hellenics, you know, and his choice of using, you know, the Hellenists instead of the Greeks, I thought was very, very relevant to China, because it's not China back then. It's, you know, it's the Huaxia, it's the Zhuxia. And so I started exploring that work a little more, and I really liked the way he said, you know, ethnicity, it's not, you know, he outlined these various positions like the circumstantialist and the constructivist. And so it was obvious that most contemporary scholars don't believe in this kind of like this belief of ethnicity, that it's defined by birth. It's something constructed within culture. And so within those parameters, ethnicity, a good definition that I thought was what he said was, you know, a group that identifies itself by looking back to the deep past and has a kind of myth of a myth of descent or a myth of kind of inherited something or other. And that they also tend to associate their group with, you know, it's kind of this direct lineage or this one line that goes back into the deep past. So a myth of descent. It doesn't have to be real, actual descent. And then also associating your group with a particular region and geography. And so there's a spatial component. There's this temporal component. And I was like, well, you know, that we could work with. And so if we transpose that to the Chinese case, you know, are these early thinkers talking about ethnicity in those terms? And it became very clear when I looked at Confucius, who was, you know, pretty much one of the first spokesmen of talking about the self. I mean, at least the earliest writings in the Analects are pretty early. You find evidence that he's really talking about a kind of Huaxia, an outline, a kind of Huaxia or Zhuxia identity. And what's so interesting and intriguing about that identity is that it's not based on kind of bloodlines or only kinship. I mean, obviously you think of Xia and you think of the descendants of the Xia. But the way he defines it is so interesting, because it's a kind of cultural notion of the Xia. And so for him, it's not kinship that is really what defines your whether you belong to this or this group or not, but that that it can be culturally acquired as well. And so you don't have to be born into it. And this he shows in so many different spots in the Analects, like he's constantly accepting people from other drastically different cultures that he thinks are kind of barbaric, but he thinks that these people have, you know, the will and the way to become civilized.
And he's also talking about, you know, how a jinzi or a gentleman, you know, can actually go to one of these cultures and totally transform the culture. And so in that sense, I feel like if we look at Confucius in this light, he becomes almost like an early proselytizer, you know, the civilizing mission. It's not like he says, go out and do this. He says, But he definitely says that if this gentleman does go out and wants to, then his very presence and the duh that he brings, you know, to the environment, is going to help civilize this culture. So it's a kind of culturally constructed notion of ethnicity that I thought was really, really unique and distinctive for China.
That's right. And one of the terms that repeatedly came up just in your comments just now really highlights something we're going to get back to and something that seems, at least to me from my perspective as one reader, to be just as crucial as the yue as a concept that's animating the book. And that's the concept of the self. The book, in many ways, is just as much about the construction of an identity of selfhood as it's about the construction of an identity of yue, right? And the two are very, very related. And this comes up really powerfully in this chapter. Now, you make a point here that much of the time that authors that you're looking at are referring to the yue, it's as a way to criticize the self. So for you, why is this important? And what do we need to understand about what's happening here to kind of understand why this is important to the larger project?
That's a great question. I felt that it was really important to show how, in a sense, self-centric these writings were. I mean, in one way, that was revealing their very biases, to show that, you know, these thinkers and these intellectuals, what were they really writing about? Well, they're mentioning the yue, but it wasn't in the interest of actually uncovering or discovering who these people were. It was about kind of using these common stock, you know, common knowledge or stock phrases or stereotypes or something to either criticize the self, or sometimes if they were more Huaxia centric, then to kind of show how great they were. But what was interesting in actually exploring the literature, you know, and just kind of looking over what we do have, because so much of the discussion in contemporary scholarship is about, oh, the Chinese were so, you know, it was this totally bigoted view of the world, and it was central states everything, and everybody else was barbarian, and that's all good and fine, and to a large extent true, but I think we overdo it. I mean, I think that at some point you look at the literature and you're realizing that a lot of people were actually critical of their own selves too, and what this culture meant, especially those that we now associate with the Taoist or, you know, these other kinds of philosophies, these kinds of approaches. They were very interested in looking to other cultures as a means of expressing, you know, either a form of cultural relativism, or at least, you know, making things a little unstable and uncertain as to how right and wrong you are, and so by getting at the kind of backstory and what these people were doing in their own texts and in their own circles, I felt like we could come to understand the limits of trying to understand factually who these Yue people were, because it wasn't talking about, you know, kind of factual Yue people. And it's very questionable as to whether or not, you know, most of these authors even had ever visited or even knew any Yue people themselves.
Great. Thank you. So as we move from this to the next chapter, we move to a chapter that looks at some of the most important physical markers of yue identity. It's another really super fascinating chapter. So you talk about a number of physical markers of yue identity here that include tattooing the body, and engraving the forehead. They include sitting in an uncouth manner. They include, which I love that, you know, reading that you kind of get self-reflexive, like, huh, I do that.
Yes.
Like, yes. Yes. Power to the uncouth. But, and you also include a kind of trope of pigeon-toed nest to describe the yuan and talk about kind of where that might come from in terms of a hearing of a term or kind of a homophone for a term that might be a more sort of a term of geographical location. Right. But what I want to ask you about is hairstyle. Okay, so you look at the importance of tropes of unbound hair, sheared hair, and something called a mallet-shaped bun. Now, I won't ask you to necessarily talk in specifics about this unless you want to, so feel free. But one of the things that I want to pull out that's, I think, of more general import here is the way that you're really beautifully integrating different kinds of source material here as a way to tell this story and to try to understand what's happening here. Now, for those of us who work on China, a lot of us, I think it's safe to say, who work on later periods really look to, and I'll just say for me, really admire scholars of early China for the way that you, in your work, integrate all kinds of material and textual sources into telling stories, right? Archaeological evidence, tomb remains, the texts on various kinds of media, inscriptions on various kinds of material objects. These are all texts that are used to tell a story. And this is something that not all of us who work in later periods are as comfortable doing. So I think this is really a marker of the real beauty of methodology that tends more to animate early Chinese scholarship on early China, and certainly that animates your scholarship here. And this for me was a real moment of wow. And here's the moment. You point us to the hairstyle of a seated figure in the Zhejiang Provincial Museum and ask us to look at the hairstyle of this figure as one possible clue that helps us to understand how these different ways of rhetorically talking about hairstyle of the Yue might have made sense and might have fit together. So, Erica, can you talk to us about that? And you can feel free to talk specifically about kind of what happened with this particular figure in this museum, or more generally, the importance of actually working with material objects like this in pulling together and interpreting textual information and textual sources.
Oh, you're so sweet to say that. I'm notoriously bad with hair. but I did write a chapter on hair because it was so important. It became something that, you know, you just come across in the literature, and then all of a sudden you get taken by it because you realize that it's all over the place and it makes no sense. And in particular, what I'm talking about is that, so it became a kind of mystery that I had to solve, you know, like what is going on here? Because the authors are just using hair as this designation to talk about these Yue peoples. But they're using so many different styles, and there's no kind of real standardized way. I mean, there might be if I were to do some kind of systematic statistical study of, you know, how many times this particular thing came up, but I didn't do that. I'm not, I don't do as well with statistical studies. So what I did was I looked at these various types of hairstyles that were being talked about in relationship to the Yue. And I wanted to, especially in this chapter, get past the actual the trope or the designation and try to contextualize these and see how these meanings, what they might mean in a larger context and not just in relationship to the Yue. So in the larger context of Chinese culture, what would these kinds of things mean? What would it mean to sit with your, like in the dustpan style, with your legs splayed out like a basically a dustpan. And what does that mean culturally? And so when you're talking about the Yue peoples who do this, how does that cast them in terms of the cultural values that you're working with? And so that was kind of the approach, the interest that I had in these two chapters, actually, because it got so long that I had to cut it up and put another part of the physical markers in a different chapter. But the hair part was about, you know, how do we understand it when some people are saying it's short hair and some people are very insistent that it's unbound hair. In fact, most of the instances I looked at were, you know, tattooed bodies and unbound hair. That was the typical, stereotypical way of referring to the Yue peoples. And so when I came across, so I did this this tour in, I think it was 2012 or so, of all of southern China. I didn't make it to Vietnam that time, but I had some archaeologist friends kind of set me up with their friends, and they showed me around the important sites, and I visited some museums on my own just to get a sense of the lay of the land and the objects that, you know, I was talking about. And it was on that trip that I was in this Zhejiang Museum and I saw this, what turned out to be actually a replica. And I didn't know it at the time because they didn't label it properly, which is so typical of Chinese museums, or some of them, at least. They just say, oh, this is this. And so I took a picture and I was so happy to have it. And they had this poster with other, even more examples of this Yue person seated. And you could totally, you know, the body was completely tattooed and they were seated in a very subservient way, like it was a servant. You know, kneeling, actually gui is the kneeling position that was actually ritually a part of the Zhou culture. So they're being used almost like servants in a sense, according to the Huaxia cultural norms, but they are totally otherified because they have the tattoos and they have the totally different style of hair. So it ended up being the cover to the book because I pursued it. I was like, this is such an amazing picture. So I contacted the museum and I said, can I, you know, get the rights to the book and we can pay and we can do all this. And they were like, we would love to help you, but we don't even actually have the rights to that picture because, or that photo, because it's the real thing, the real object. We only have the replica, and the real object is at this the Wuyue Cultural Museum of Zhejiang, which was out in the boondocks somewhere outside of Shaoxing, and I didn't make it to that. And it turns out that this was a part of a staff, and I posted on Facebook, so I got a lot of good feedback from people who had been familiar with these kinds of staffs and their purposes in early China. And what happened was that I finally got the permission, but the hairstyle was both at once, this kind of short hairstyle in the front, kind of very short bangs. And then it was also cut in the back, very short, kind of up to the top of the neckline. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there were these, so it was unbound in that sense and short. And then there was all this other stuff going on at the same time, these braids and these little buns. And I was just like, wow, I could totally see how somebody looking at this, you know, different people would come at this with different ideas. Like, okay, some could call it the bun and focus on that aspect, but then there's also the short hair and all in one, you know. It was like, wow, you know, that might be what's happening here. Or it also might just be that they're being totally careless with their way of referring to the other, and they don't really know, and they're just calling upon tropes. But it was just an interesting way of looking at, you know, the material evidence and seeing that, wow, you know, it's kind of like the elephant in the room, and people touch on different parts of it. and then if you really understand what's going on, you could see the whole picture and it all kind of fits together.
Awesome. Thank you. So as we move to the next chapter, we move to another chapter that also takes us into another aspect of kind of the importance of physical tropes of identity. And this looks at tropes that identified the Yue as, among other things, creatures of the sea. You look at the importance of affiliations with snakes and with dragons. You take us into tropes that identified the South as a disease-ridden land. And you also talk about the importance of tropes of the South as a land of swords and magical knives. It's really, really cool. Now, all of this, I mean, we could spend easily another hour just talking about these super cool, like, snakes and knives, right? Like, who doesn't?
It is really cool.
I mean, like, who doesn't love that, right? Snakes and magical knives and, like, dragons and the hair.
And awesome swimmers and, yeah.
Totally, like, awesome swimmers. And so we're not going to do that. but listeners, please do look carefully at this chapter because it's awesome in all kinds of ways. But what I want to just kind of spend a little bit of time bringing out is one of the really important conceptual points that I think emerges from this chapter and that we've kind of touched on, but maybe not dug into in a really deep way. And so we can maybe start to do that now. Now, you talk about the ways in this material that the Huaxia are using these images of the other, right, the magical knives and the disease-ridden lands and the snakes, to help center and unify their sense of self. So again, this notion of self comes back, while simultaneously destabilizing its sense of superiority. So you raise here and ask us in the book to really think about this logic of Huaxia centrality. Now, since this has come up in some ways before, and it will come up again in the end of the book, let's spend just a little bit of time talking about the importance of centrality here, this logic of Huaxia centrality. Can you talk to us a bit about this and in terms of what you think is so central here? No pun intended, actually. Sorry.
Right. Well, so I mean, this was one of those points that, I mean, I felt kind of embarrassed making because obviously when you talk about early China, everybody knows that it's the central states and centrality was an absolute, absolutely just critical aspect of the conception of these peoples, right? And there are lots of works that talk about, you know, even cosmologically speaking, how that centrality was kind of mapped out in, you know, the cosmology and in the way that, you know, people dealt with space and, you know, and material objects and things like that. Graves. And so I felt like, oh, am I saying something new? But at the same time, and I don't know if I really got into this as much, and maybe I can explore it in future projects. But at the same time, I felt that there was really, really something that, you know, textually speaking, there was a kind of assumption of every time, you know, that you or that the author would bring up, you know, some kind of comparison between the self and the other, it was always this assumption that the self is where the center is. And so I wanted to kind of, at some level, I felt like it was a kind of philosophical issue. It was almost like a psychological issue that something very deep is going on with these texts. We see it all the time. And maybe it's just a normal, natural thing for any author to do. But really, when they're outlining identity and identity formation, it's the process is very similar. And it involves, you know, kind of assuming that everything you know and all of the things that are familiar is the center. And then everything else, you know, as you move out from there, and there's this kind of spatial thing going on, spatial processing, it's in your mind even that you're imagining distant things or even just things that are not as familiar as somehow more distant. And I thought that... that was what I was seeing in almost every single case. And that's kind of what I started to bring out, I think, in these chapters, but I don't think I explored it as well as I could in the future, maybe.
Mm. So. Well, thank you. Well, I thought you explored it really well. So I really actually liked that part of the chapter. But there are two more chapters and a conclusion to go. So let's keep going. Chapter 8 brings us into a discussion. Well, first of all, it brings us into the fourth major part of the book, which you call Performing Yue, political drama, intrigue, and armed resistance, and it looks at all of those things. And the eighth chapter brings us into a discussion, also, again, a really interesting discussion of Yue resistance to the Han Imperium. Now, this chapter draws mainly from the Shiji and the Han Shu accounts of the Southern Yue, among other sources, such as a tomb of the king of the Southern Yue, which is really interesting here. Now, the chapter helps us, among other things, re-envision the importance for understanding cultural change of elite aristocratic people on the frontier. And it sort of refocuses the narrative on elite aristocratic people on the frontier, because in this way, it's pushing back against some other scholarship that tends to assume that if you're looking for evidence of cultural change, those are not the people that you would look to. And so among the many contributions this is making, it's asking us to really critically look at that assumption and see what we can gain when we look to these people for evidence of and to understand cultural change. Now, to meet their own needs, these people that you introduce us to, and there are a series of figures, some of whom are naming themselves emperors, right?
Right.
To meet their own needs, you make the point here that they are, in the words of the book, adopting and adapting Han imperial tools of control and using them for their own purposes. So in this way, the chapter challenges an idea that the rulers who are identified here went native, right, in quotes, and instead the chapter suggests that they went sovereign or went imperial. This is really interesting, and could you talk about that for us?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. That's also what I consider to be a more important point. You're just like picking all the...
Oh, it's because the book's so clear. I mean,
you have a knack for it. Okay. Well, in any case, it makes me happy that you noticed that, because then it means that maybe I did convey it properly. But this idea was, you know, I struggled with it a lot, because what are these guys doing? They're kind of expats. Some of them were not even really Yue, but they were coming from northern China and basically just moving in and seeing an opportunity and taking it. And so I think this is really, you know, these last two chapters to me are where I really want to just kind of move on from here, because I know I'm jumping ahead, but I feel like that's where it's at. You know, if you talk about, this is how you deconstruct a notion of sinicization, that this idea that, oh yeah, just because in the material culture we see Han things all of a sudden, then that means that translates into an interpretation, a very simplistic interpretation that, oh, they're becoming more Han. And that's what it's this kind of takeover interpretation, like, you know, cultural conquest, that somehow, or even trickle down, that it's coming and it's taking over the place. But that kind of effaces the entire history of what's going on among people. And when you look at that history and you take take into account, the agency of the subaltern, if you want to use some really contemporary terms, the agency of the subaltern in relationship to the imperium or in relationship to a dominant culture or something like that, you start to realize, and it doesn't even have to be a subaltern. In many of these cases, as you mentioned, these are people who are very, you know, politically powerful. They're calling themselves emperors of Southern Yue. They're defying emperors, you know, the empire to the north. And so they have a lot of agency, and what's so interesting is how they, you know, the political stuff at the time and all of the situations they find themselves in, starts to affect the way that they're, kind of wielding, symbols of power and just basically using whatever they can to dominate and to be that sovereign. And one of that the best methods back in the day was to use this technology of this, of the Imperium and imperial technologies. That was, it's not Han, it wasn't Qin, but it was a kind of technology that was being developed farther north that they could basically tap into and go sovereign. And so all of these accounts that talk about them as, you know, they went native or they did this and how much of the culture did they absorb or whatever, I felt like that was kind of missing the point, because when you look at what's happening, it's about political jockeying and, you know, for power and positioning yourself in an unfavorable way.
Now, this you mentioned, and I think this is really important to highlight, this point about agency. And you can hear the sirens in the background also highlighting this. This is the universe telling us, yes, agency is really important here. So if you can hear that, I'm sure that is why the police sirens are going off outside. So well
right,
done.
Right, exactly.
but this point about agency and sort of using this analysis to try to get at something we might consider to be agency also comes up in the last body chapter of the book. And this is a ninth chapter that looks specifically at cases of armed resistance to the Han Imperium and takes, you know, takes from these accounts, a similar point as the one you've just made about Han agency, or about Yue agency rather. Now, can you talk a little bit about how that comes out of these accounts insofar as what strikes you as most interesting and important about these accounts of rebellion and armed resistance? And here, these include rebellion of two sisters, right? So I just want to highlight that also for listeners. We're not just talking about men here. There's a really cool Queen Dowager in the previous chapter, and there are two really cool sisters who are really powerful right here. So
that's right.
So that's important. So I just want to mark that.
Right,
that's
it good. Is. Absolutely.
So how does this issue of agency come out for you in terms of how you understand what's happening with these accounts of armed resistance?
Well, that was something that I was looking for throughout the sources that I had. And unfortunately, it's really hard to get at because, you know, as we mentioned in the beginning, a lot of these sources really don't talk about the Yue voice, or they don't really get into what these people, they kind of, at most, they get it cardboard kind of representations of these people. And so it really depended on the source. For instance, the two Chong sisters, or the Jung sisters, that became, you know, basically heroines of early Vietnam. They're still in the histories there. I mean, this is, you know, Vietnamese people look back to these sisters and say, hey, you know, this shows our fighting spirit. You know, this shows that we were fighting with those Chinese from really early on. And that particular case was a little bit disappointing to me because there was so little that was actually being said about them. And it was all about this great colonialist from the Han, Ma Yuan, who comes in and, you know, defeats them and, you know, cuts off their heads and hangs them in the marketplace and then starts, you know, his civilizing mission. And so it was hard to kind of read between the lines, and that's what I wanted to do. But there were a few instances where I had enough information where I felt pretty sure that I could piece together a story that actually said something about your identity and the formation of it during that period. Not like Vietnamese identity 1,000 years later, where they're looking back to the Chong sisters and using that. But really, you know, is there an example of how your identity is being used at the time, you know, in relationship to by these people, by these individual actors, as a means of kind of fighting back and forming a sense of group identity because of this encounter of resistance. Or this military encounter. So that's kind of what I was doing. And it was hard. these sources are not easy to deal with. So I feel like, you know, I try my best, but then there's all sorts of limitations. But that, you know, everybody deals with that. So.
Yeah. So there's also, as we're kind of coming to the conclusion of our conversation, there's also a conclusion in the book that really brings out some of the things that we've talked about. And I won't ask you to talk too much about it because we've already kind of touched on some of the really important points that come up. But I'll just echo some of them here just to highlight their importance. And those include the ways that Huaxia identity here is what you call a function of the logic of centrality. So we've talked a little bit about that. And you also emphasize the ways that this analysis shows us and helps us understand that the concept of sinicization is really of limited usefulness. And it really pushes back in interesting ways on that concept. So, Erica, there's a ton of material in the book that we didn't talk about, right? There's a lot that we could talk more about. But at this point, is there anything in particular or really anything in general that didn't yet come up but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Thanks for asking that. I actually do have one more comment that I thought of as I was talking, and it was this idea that I came to relatively late, but it's pretty obvious. And it was that, or actually maybe it's not so obvious that really when authors were thinking about Huaxia and talking about themselves every time they, or not every time, but often when you brought up this other called the Yue, it wasn't just, you know, randomly choosing and other. There were specific reasons that were very relevant to the actual creation of this really, really massive concept of Huaxia. You know, kind of like this Yue was the foil for this massive concept of the Huaxia. That was not just, you know, it wasn't because Yue was the South and there was some kind of, directionality going there, but that this was a because there are other terms they could have used that deal with the South, North, you know, East and West and kind of more schematic terms, but that Huaxia Yue relationship was very unique in that it was really a cultural identification, and that they really, really saw Yue as this kind of cultural mega cultural complex that could help define themselves. And I don't know if I said that right just now, but there's something there that I think was really revealing as to why Huaxia, Yue was like the perfect foil for this mega concept of Huaxia that didn't really make sense itself.
Great. So I understand just from talking to you a little bit before the recording that this is actually part of a larger project. And so as we come to our conclusion, what are you working on now? Sort of what's next for you? What's currently animating your research and what are you inspired by?
Well, I'm still interested in this project, actually, because it's just so there's so much you can do with, the southern frontier, the history of the southern frontier, moving into different periods, especially periods where the histories might yield a little more information in terms of the kinds of questions I'm interested in. I'm interested in issues of comparative empires. Like, was there something unique about early Chinese empires that helped basically spawn this sense of China as big and, you know, imperial and, you know, why did it go the way of China and become this one country in a sense now, instead of going the way of Europe, for example, that is all these different tiny little countries, maintaining their senses of identity distinct from each other. And so that's kind of, you know, why is China so large? The question that fundamentally fuels me at this time. And I feel like now that this book is done, I can kind of move on to these higher order questions of imperial control, imperial reach, especially, you know, and use the southern frontier and this relationship between China and Southeast Asia as a kind of, as the data, as a source of data for answering larger questions like that.
Well, best of luck with that work. I will look forward to talking with you again about the next book. Let's just keep this going.
You're so sweet. It might be a while, but I'll do my best.
That's
Thank
okay.
You.
open invitation and I'll stay tuned. But for the meantime, thank you so much, Erica. It's really been a pleasure and congratulations on what I hope is obvious to me, at least, and hopefully to listeners, is a really inspiring book in all kinds of ways. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for choosing it to interview.
You have been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we will see you next time.